We're ready now for our final case of the day, LaPlante against Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance Company. Mr. Hoflick.
May it please the Court. My name is Adam Hoflick, and I'm here today on behalf of Northwestern Mutual. This case involves a high-stakes, nationwide class action that is one of a series of high-stakes class actions brought by plaintiff's counsel relating to annuity policies by Northwestern Mutual. It is not a case relating solely to a dividend calculation under that annuity. Plaintiffs have brought theories based on the mismarketing of the annuity, based on a failure to notify annuitants of a change in how dividends are calculated, based on concealment of the way those dividends were calculated over a period of decades, and over misstatements made to regulators, not just in Wisconsin, but in New York. The district court erred by broadly construing the exception to the Class Action Fairness Act's broad jurisdiction over duplicative class actions that are filed in state court and that parties have the right to remove to federal court. The district court also erred by holding that solely Wisconsin law would govern all of the claims of annuitants, despite the fact that there is an express choice of law clause in the amendment to the policies that the annuitants signed. In fact, more than 10,000 annuitants signed that choice of law provision. More than 10,000 also didn't sign that provision. But Wisconsin law recognizes and respects choice of law clauses, and the district court here failed to in a sweeping ruling that would have grave implications for the ability of parties to choose the law that governs their agreement. The district court also erred by failing to recognize that in Wisconsin, the choice of law for insurance and annuity policies is governed by the law of the state where the annuitant lived when she applied for her policy. Finally, the district court erred by failing to recognize that given the burden on the party showing an exception to CAFA's broad jurisdiction must demonstrate that the law of Wisconsin applies, and here the plaintiff failed to compare the laws of the different states that were at issue, instead solely stating that Wisconsin law should govern without that analysis, and the district court therefore erred. This is not the narrow dispute among current holders of a policy, of current shareholders of a corporation that is peculiar to a corporation and that would fall within the internal affairs exception to CAFA. This case should stay in federal court. As an initial matter, this court has broad jurisdiction over class actions. In Hart versus Federal Express, this court made clear that CAFA's provision should be read broadly.
I wish you would avoid weird acronyms and initialisms. Using real English words is helpful to generalist judges.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Class Action Fairness Acts.
Just call it the Act.
The Act's provisions should be read broadly with a strong preference that interstate class action should be in federal court. Both this court's precedent and the Senate Act supporting the Act, the Senate report supporting the Act, made clear that the purpose of the exceptions is not to disrupt the balance between cases that stay in federal court under the Securities Litigation Uniform Standard Act of 1998 and cases that might stay peculiarly in Delaware or other state courts to govern corporate matters like how a corporation keeps its minutes, and cases that should be removed under the Class Action Fairness Act and the congressional goal of making sure that things like duplicative high state class actions don't stay in state court. Here, as a threshold matter, the requirements of 1332 are met. We have more than...
I don't think anybody's fighting about that, so maybe let's go right to the exception.
We will, Your Honor. And neither of the exceptions are met. First, and I'll turn to each of these individually, this is not an internal affair. We have allegations relating to mismarketing, failure to notify, concealment. We have a specific request for a finding and a specific finding that there is a predicate for punitive damages. A former owner of a company, a former annuitant, and many states would call this a creditor-debtor relationship rather than a shareholder relationship, but a former annuitant who is suing for a predicate for punitive damages, that's many things, but it is not the internal affair of a corporation or the sort of thing that was meant to be decided peculiarly by Delaware courts.
Standard thing to which the internal affairs doctrine applies, which is the election of members of the board of directors, whether they're for staggered terms, who's on the board, and so on. If there were a claim that a corporation had committed fraud on its investors in circulating the proxy materials, do you think the claim of fraud and a request for punitive damages would take it outside the internal affairs doctrine?
Yes, I do, Your Honor, and I believe that your opinion in Katz versus Girardi makes that very clear.
My opinion? Are you referring to an opinion for the Seventh Circuit?
Yes, I apologize, Your Honor. The opinion authored by you for the Seventh Circuit in Katz versus Girardi makes clear that if a plaintiff has two theories, one of the theory alleging, and there it involved certain securities coming out of Salva Reed, if it involves the ability to enforce that term, then that might come under Section D3 of the exception. However, if it relates to fraud in the marketing of the security or it relates to common law fraud, and there are two theories, then the law of the Seventh Circuit is that that is not internal.
You were listening carefully to my question. My question didn't have anything to do with the sale or marketing of the security. It had to do with the conduct of an election by people who already owned the securities. And I asked whether you thought that claiming that the corporation had committed fraud and asking for punitive damages took the case outside the scope of the internal affairs exception. And you said yes, and I found that a very puzzling and implausible answer. Now, maybe you're now suggesting otherwise?
Perhaps I read too much into your comment relating to fraud, Your Honor. But given that the fraud aspect of that is a peculiarly state law issue or particularly common law issue as opposed to what I would view as an internal affair issue, I would see that coming outside of the internal
affairs
exception. Mr. Hoffman,
where would you draw the line on the exception? Is there any kind of claim of nonpayment that would ever fit in the exception?
I think there is, Your Honor.
Give me an example of that, please.
If we were talking about a claim relating to the physical calculation of the dividend, then we would be telling you first, we think that probably goes to the insurance commissioner of Wisconsin because he would have primary jurisdiction over that claim. If we were to lose that, as we have in certain instances, then we would claim that that's an internal affair of the corporation. But when the plaintiff has additional theories and seeks findings relating to those additional theories, and they are a support for their grievance, we don't think that comes within the internal affairs exception because the statute states that the claim, the theory of liability, must relate solely to internal affairs. And when you have additional aspects that come outside of the internal affairs, then we are in the situation where the CAFA exception, Acts exception does not apply.
A claim for recalculation or adjustment to the way in which the dividends are calculated and seeking perhaps restitutionary damages would be inside the doctrine or the exception, I should say, the internal affairs exception, but another kind of a claim that relates to the dividend is outside of it?
Your Honor, I think that's exactly what this Court's holding in Appert says. It says that when you look at the word solely, or when you look at the word relates to, or I'm sorry, when you look at the word solely in conjunction to the word concerns, which is the first exception to the Act that's mentioned in the Appert opinion, then we look at what does concerns mean. And the question is, do you stretch it to the definitional limits? And the court says no. If something is a dividend calculation, just a precise calculation, it's hard to argue that that is not internal affair. But if you take it a step removed and then you base a fraud count on that, then this court's holding in the Katz versus Girardi case is very clear that that is outside the exception to the Act.
Well, the state law causes of action that were alleged in this case were for breach of contract, breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, and breach of fiduciary duty. Now, I question whether the state court's judgment was properly within the scope of the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act. It doesn't read like a declaratory judgment and sought declarations of liability and predicates for punitive damages, et cetera, and was, in fact, structured in that way. But that's a separate question. Those were the parameters of the claim. They weren't sounding in fraud. They were sounding in breach of contract, breach of the duty of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing, and breach of the fiduciary duties owed by the company and its agents to the annuitants, all stemming from this dispute about how to properly calculate the dividend. Fraud was part of the factual backdrop, and there were, in fact, adjudications in the declaratory judgment that the company had engaged in fraudulent behavior, both with respect to marketing and a cover-up, but it wasn't a fraud claim.
Your Honor, I actually think that the plaintiff did bring a mismarketing claim, and they did bring a failure to notify claim, and they did claim that we gave improper information to our agents, which then assumedly went to the annuitants. So they are, however they're labeling them, they are bringing claims that sound in fraud. And if we look at the cases that come that relate to the exceptions to the Act, we are in a world where it doesn't necessarily have to resound in fraud. For example, fiduciary duty claims are not necessarily internal affairs. They can be outside the internal affairs. After the Pew case that came out of the Second Circuit, which was kept in federal court, it was very clear, as well as a number of cases from the Southern District of Illinois, that even if you bring a breach of fiduciary duty claim, that that claim can be outside the exception. We have the Smith case from the District of Wisconsin, where we have Judge Randa holding that a breach of fiduciary duty claim is not within the exception when what it is seeking does not relate solely to the internal affairs. And so what is alleged here, their theories are not theories relating to the internal affairs of the company. This is not the peculiar sort of a lawsuit that needs to be determined among shareholders. In fact, this is a lawsuit that is not peculiar in any way. It's somebody suing for a breach of an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing in mismarketing. That's not the sort of thing that can only be brought among shareholders.
Mr. Hoffman, will we find a claim of mismarketing in the complaint?
You will find a claim of mismarketing in the findings that are requested by the plaintiff. I would refer the court to page.
Is that speaking to the cover-up or to?
That speaks to the mismarketing. It speaks to the cover-up. It speaks to the failure to inform people. It speaks to the alleged misstatements and misleading the New York regulators. It deals with, they asked for a specific finding on the predicate for punitive damages. So if we look at the, we have this at pages 336 to 343 to 431 in our appendix, and we also have it at page 150 to 152 where the judge made specific findings. And as this court's opinion in the Nagy case makes clear, once the case has proceeded past the complaint, we don't look just at the complaint, we look at what happened in the case. And here we have not only requested findings by the plaintiffs, but we have specific findings by the trial court. Your Honor, I see that my light is on. I would ask that I reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Let me begin by addressing the court's question as to whether mismarketing is in the complaint or not. Mismarketing is not in the complaint. The first time that the term mismarketing was used was in the defendant's opposition to our motion to remand. The claim that is made is directly stated by the district court on page 3 of the appendix, in which the district court says that in the present case, members of the putative class sue defendant in their capacity as defendant's owners, claiming the defendant improperly calculated their dividends and thereby breached its contractual and fiduciary duties to them. That is the claim. That is the source of the claim, which the Second Circuit in Greenwich Diversified Financial Services held was critical for the construction of this.
Counsel, if I could interrupt, this comes in a very different, or comes to us and came to the district court in a very different posture. It came into federal court after a declaratory judgment decision of, I don't know, 70, 80, maybe many more pages that adjudicates much more than what was artfully pled in this case as just a breach of contract and breach of fiduciary duty claim. There's much more to this case than that based on the findings that were litigated and requested and awarded in the state court declaratory judgment. And as I said earlier, I question whether this judgment is within the scope of the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act under Wisconsin law. It doesn't read like a declaratory judgment. It reads like a decision after a bench trial on questions of liability and damages and causation. But setting that aside, there's much more to this case than a question of whether dividends were properly calculated.
Your Honor, I need to partially agree and partially disagree with the court.
I thought maybe you would.
If you look at the trial court decision, the March 7th, 2011 trial court decision, at Appendix 140, at the bottom of the page, what the court says, this is the trial court's decision after the trial. The narrow issue of this case focuses on Northwestern Mutual's actions in unilaterally creating, implementing, and concealing the 1985 change which fundamentally changed the pre-MN annuity contract. And the court is absolutely crystal clear that it is not adjudicating any claims or making any findings with respect to any wrongful conduct of the defendants prior to that change. This idea that there's somehow a fraudulent inducement, a misrepresentation claim, a mismarketing claim, or as counsel said in the opening argument, that there was a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing by mismarketing the annuities is simply not accurate. We have never contended that any of the statements that were made by Northwestern Mutual to the annuitant people when they were buying their contracts were false. The contrary, we said they're true.
It's not a fraud in the inducement claim. It's a claim of fraudulent conduct in the nature of concealment during the course of the adoption of this change in the manner in which the dividends were calculated, and then covering it up with respect to the marketing of the new newly packaged annuities.
But Your Honor, that's not a fraud claim. I mean, what we're saying is that they owed the company and its officers, owed the owners, the duty of disclosure, duty of fair disclosure as to what changes had been made. These all relate to the changes in the dividend policy. We're saying the dividend policy was wrong, that the change was wrong. Not the marketing. Nothing to do with the marketing being wrong. Marketing was completely correct. What we said was that the change was wrong and that the failure to disclose and provide proper information was wrong. Not fraud. simply a breach of the fiduciary duty that they had as a result of the owner-manager relationship. So this falls, we think, clearly within both what counsel referenced, the Pugh case.
The findings that the state trial court made with respect to the dishonest and misleading conduct are just superfluous?
No, Your Honor. The court made clear why it was making those findings. Pages 122 and 123 of the appendix, and I apologize to the court. In our brief, we said it was pages, I think, 60 and 61. That was because we made a mistake. We cited the pages of the opinion. It's really 122 and 123 of the appendix. The court makes clear that it's referencing the testimony about the marketing. It says not because it relates to the state of mind of the annuitants, but because it shows the state of mind of Northwestern Mutual, because one of the issues in terms of breach of fiduciary duty on Wisconsin law is you need to show that they knew what they were saying or doing was inconsistent with what they had said. And everything that we have said in our case throughout, and everything that they have said up until the removal, and everything that every court has said, is that this is about the change in the dividend policy and the failure to disclose properly what that change was. This is not a case in which we are alleging anything wrong with the marketing. And both the Pugh case, which is cited by this court in Katz, and the Katz case draws a distinction between a case that involves fulfilling the terms, in that case of security, or in this case of an ownership relationship, and a case that involves a claim that somehow in the purchase of that security or the purchase of this annuity policy, there was something wrong. We're not alleging the latter. We've never alleged the latter. Contrary to what they have said in their briefs.
I think we have your position on this. I'd like to, with my colleague's consent, like to take you in a different direction.
Yes.
Many of these annuity contracts have choice of law clauses that are choosing law other than Wisconsin. And I appreciate your contention that they don't pertain to this, but let's assume that you don't persuade us on that. You then have the district court's holding that these choice of law clauses are unenforceable. I read the district court to say that what I first do is I apply Wisconsin's usual choice of law principles. I determine that Wisconsin law applies, and whenever a Wisconsin court determines that its own common law principles apply Wisconsin domestic law, no contract as a matter of law can provide anything else. Now, that approach, of course, makes all choice of law clauses invalid all the time. And I wonder whether there's any Wisconsin case that supports that or anything close to that.
Your Honor, I think that in the very broadest statement that the court makes, I do not believe there is. But I don't think that is what the district court was saying. I think
certainly what the district court did, the district court said, I've now applied Wisconsin's choice of law principles. They point to Wisconsin law. The contracts point to different law. Therefore, the contracts are invalid.
But the
claiming nothing, by the way.
One of the things that the court did cite was the particular statute that is involved here. And one of the things that the court was saying was that when you're dealing with the internal affairs of a Wisconsin corporation, and particularly when you're dealing with the internal affairs of a Wisconsin corporation, dealing with a specific statute.
If Wisconsin had some statute or even a common law saying the internal affairs doctrine is so entrenched in Wisconsin that nobody can opt out of it, that I could understand. But, of course, Beloit Liquidating says exactly the opposite. The company in Beloit Liquidating was a Delaware company. And Wisconsin said, despite the fact that this is a Delaware company, we're going to apply Wisconsin law. So Wisconsin doesn't hold the internal affairs doctrine as beyond modification. It was modified in Beloit liquidating itself.
Yes, but Your Honor, in Beloit, what they were not doing is modifying the issues that are involved here, which are the issues between the owners of the company and the company or the company's managers.
Look, maybe my question isn't clear. I'm interested, at least as a factual matter, in whether there is any Wisconsin case which says that a choice of law clause is invalid for the simple reason that either it involves a Wisconsin corporation or Wisconsin choice of law principles would point to Wisconsin law in the absence of the clause. Any such case?
Your Honor, I do not believe that there's any such case like that, but I would just ask the Court to consider these issues with respect to this particular case and why I think this case is different than the hypothetical that the Court puts. First, this is a case that involves the internal affairs of Wisconsin Corporation.
In a jurisdiction that doesn't follow the internal affairs doctrine.
But Your Honor, all I would ask is that the Court compare what was at issue in Beloit and what's at issue here. But I do want to get the other points out if I can. Second, this is a situation in which there is a clear, unambiguous statute found by the trial court, so found by the court below, that directly dealt with this issue in terms of dividends. This was the court relied on this in terms of its decision, in terms of the Wisconsin court would not apply the choice of law. I just want to be sure the court focuses on something before my time runs out. And this is a case in which the Wisconsin courts have said, the parties have said, the choice of law provision does not apply here.
I have your argument in that respect. Let me put the question in a different way. The usual reason why a state might refuse to enforce a choice of law clause is that it points to another jurisdiction whose law is repugnant to the home state. Is there any jurisdiction that is pointed to by these choice of law clauses that adopts a rule of law, contract or otherwise, that is repugnant to Wisconsin public policy?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I believe that if the choice of law had gone to someplace else, they would have referred it back to Wisconsin anyway, because Wisconsin was the source of it. But the issue here in terms of policy is because, and this is Wisconsin policy, and it's other states' policies too, is you need a single state a law that's going to determine these kind of issues. As Northwestern itself has argued in other cases, you can't have multiple different states' laws applying to the internal calculation of a dividend or what kind of notice has to be given to the owners of the company. If you had that, you would have, as Northwestern Mutual has said in other cases, chaos. And so Wisconsin law applies.
I'm not sure why you think there would be chaos here. It's very common in insurance contracts, and I'm sure annuity contracts by non-mutual firms, for the law of the policyholders or the annuitant state to apply. And states will have slight differences in their insurance law about what kind of notice an annuitant will receive. Nobody thinks that produces chaos.
No, it doesn't, Your Honor, because what you're talking about in those cases is coverage issues. You're talking about what are your rights under the policy. You're not talking about what are the rights of the owners of the company with respect to the company itself. And when you're dealing with what the rights are of the owners of the company to the company itself, that is clearly what has always been thought of as the internal affairs of the company. It is what cases outside of Wisconsin have said. You need to apply the law of the state where it's incorporated. What I said before was that if the court below had said, okay, we've got to look at these choice of law provisions in each of these other states, they would have found that the choice of law provisions in those other states would have referred it back to Wisconsin law. Wisconsin law was going to apply in any event in this case with respect to how should the dividends be calculated and what kind of notice was the company required to give its owners. And the reason that I reference the fact that everybody, all the courts and all the parties up until now, have said that the choice of law provision did not deal with the issues in this case is because particularly if you've got some kind of ambiguity of that type, you're not going to have something that is going to be forward to a policy outside of the state of Wisconsin. I think my time is up. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Hoflick?
Please, Your Honor. If I might take a moment, I'll address both of the principal points addressed by Mr. Boyce. First, on the choice of law issue, as the court recognized, Wisconsin does not recognize the internal affairs doctrine. That's what it said in the Beloit case. Second, Wisconsin does respect choice of law clauses in contracts. Third,
except when it doesn't.
Except when it doesn't, and Your Honor, there's no case that is anywhere close to this. There's two cases that have been cited by the plaintiffs, both the Drinkwater case and the Bush case. The Bush case deals with a situation where there's a statute that says you cannot contract around this. Here, the Wisconsin insurance statute, section 362, has section 0.41 that says here's the clauses you can't put in life insurance contracts. If they wanted to say no choice of law clauses, they would have put it in there. They didn't. Third, Wisconsin has a Supreme Court case, Solberg, that says that the residence of the person applying for insurance governs their policy. So we are in every which way, shape, and form in a new world if we say that insurance companies and their annuitants can't do this.
That case didn't entail a question of internal affairs, I think.
No, it didn't, but Wisconsin doesn't recognize internal affairs.
It doesn't follow that doctrine religiously. I don't think it's quite fair to say that it doesn't recognize the doctrine as a part of the analysis. It just doesn't make it outcome determinative as it does as it operates in other jurisdictions. I think that's the better reading of the Beloit case.
Wouldn't you say Beloit leaves it open?
No, I wouldn't say Beloit leaves it open. What Beloit says, we've got a Delaware corporation, we've got a headquarters in Wisconsin. It's a choice of law doctrine that says you apply the state of incorporation so that the people working at the corporation know what laws will govern and so they can regulate their own affairs. And it says that doctrine doesn't apply here. And certainly that's something that the members of a corporation could bargain away. It doesn't suggest you wouldn't allow a choice of law clause to override it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.